Good morning, everyone. We have a real treat this morning with our speaker, Megan DeFranza. I know you have seen a description of her abstract and a little bit about her. It's on page 10 of your program if you want to read a little more. But I'm going to give you just a short introduction to her. Megan DeFranza is an internationally recognized expert at the intersection of the science of sex difference and Christian theology. In 2012, she was one of 9 scholars invited to Manchester University for the first global conference in the English-speaking world on intersex theology and the Bible. Megan earned an MA in biblical languages and an MA in theology from Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary and Evangelical Seminary, and her PhD from Marquette University. Her books and articles are regularly used as textbooks in colleges and in seminaries. The educational documentary Megan co-directed with her husband, Stories of Intersex and Faith, has been used at churches and conferences around the globe. Dr. DeFranza has also witnessed how inadequate and distorted teachings about sex differences, gender and sexuality cause relational and sexual dysfunction for many Christians. Therefore, in recent years, she has added therapeutic training to her scholarly work because she is committed to the healing of the whole person, spirit, mind, emotions, and body. She is passionate about scholarly research presented in ways that are accessible to non-specialists and characterized by the fruit of the Spirit. And having only met her in person less than 48 hours ago, I can tell you that she is a person of integrity, passion, and compassion, and it's our privilege to hear from her this morning. God bless you as you share with us, Megan.
I guess we all do it. When somebody gives birth, everybody asks them, is it a boy or a girl? What if it's neither?
I have XY chromosomes. Because I don't react to the male hormones that my body makes, it converts it to female hormones, and that's what I react to.
1.5 to 2% of the population is born with an intersex trait.
I was born approximately 2 months premature. They pretty much found out right away that I was different.
The doctors came in and said, oh, there's a problem and it's easy to fix. It'll take a surgery, the kid will never remember it, everything will be fine. Of course, that's not true. It's rarely true.
Those doctors think they're doing no harm because they see the harm that comes to a person that's differently gendered as being much greater than anything that could be done medically to our bodies.
The silence on our part make us a greater part of the problem as opposed to part of the solution. In certain religious communities, some people want to relegate these issues to like human brokenness or sin, not understanding the deeply biological, psychological, and physiological issues that are involved here.
When you say that intersex is a result of the fall, what I hear is it's legitimate to forcibly alter my body.
Many parents and doctors feel like God only wants male or female. So they see intersex as a problem that needs to be fixed. 10 to 15% of medical students say religion is why they don't want to provide health care to people with sex and gender differences. But intersex people just see things differently.
I believe firmly that it was God's intent. God doesn't make mistakes.
I've kind of embraced being intersex. I've met a whole community of people like me.
If I'd never had the first surgery, I would never have required a surgery in my life.
It is undeniably, unquestionably time to stop cutting the genitals of infants and children just to put them into male-female boxes to placate our cultural discomfort.
If there are laws to protect all of us, that will be my restitution.
Maybe in the case of intersex, it's society that needs to be healed and not us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here this morning, and I want to thank the conference planners for the gracious invitation to be with you today. It's my honor, and I'm grateful for the work that all of you have done in the sciences. I'm a theologian. But my doctoral dissertation was on sex differences as well as theology and the image of God, and that can be found in my book, Sex Difference in Christian Theology, Male, Female, and Intersex in the Image of God. I don't know how many of you knew Hessel or Bud Bauma, who I see some hands, taught biology at Calvin College for a number of years. He was studying intersex from the biological perspective since the 1970s. And I once saw him put a slide up on a board where he said, here's a slide of gonadal tissue. Up here, you can see testicular tissue. And down here, you can see ovarian tissue. This is the work that he was doing. I'm not a biologist, but I'm dependent on people like Dr. Bauma and like many of you who have done the hard scientific work. My job as a theologian is to say, given this scientific work, how do we think about this Christianly? How do we relate this to scripture? How do we relate this to Christian history and tradition? I wanted to start with the documentary because whenever I speak, I get uncomfortable speaking for a community that I'm not a part of. And so I like to give them the voice that comes first. Would love to show you all the full documentary. It's 80 minutes long, so it didn't fit in the program here, even though we wanted to do that. But these are Christians on this video, many from very conservative Christian denominations. Leanne is a part of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Megan is a homeschooler from Colorado Springs who grew up in the Missouri Synod Lutheran. Anunnaki is a Catholic. And Marissa grew up in a Baptist home. So these are conservative Christians whose bodies were born different than the majority and who have had to wrestle with these questions in their own lives. So I like to give them the priority of place. So intersex is a new term, but some of you may be familiar with some of these older terms like hermaphrodite and androgyne. Differences of sex development is a newer term, or variations in sex traits you'll hear sometimes. In the medical community, it's often called disorders of sex development, but that presumes a certain stance toward bodily difference. And in the community, some people see their intersex difference as a medical problem, medical challenge, and others say, well, yeah, I have medical challenges, everybody does, but the way that affects my sex and gender is not the medical problem. So a few people in the intersex community will use the word hermaphrodite of themselves, but we don't use that for other people unless they tell them that's the term they prefer. Intersex folks have a hard time going to the emergency room. Like, how do you tell doctors, my body is really different? And so one of my friends, actually Anunnaki in the film, says, whenever I go to the emergency room, I need to say one word, hermaphrodite. And then they know what I'm talking about, and I don't have to explain my particular variation. I'm going to put up several kinds of variations of intersex traits. These are some of the most common are the first two, congenital adrenal hyperplasia and androgen insensitivity. Intersex occurs, and I had some help on the board here, thank you. Intersex is a term that relates to biological sex, and biological sex has many different traits. It happens at the genetic level, the gonadal level, the hormone level, the cellular level, internal reproductive structures, genitals, secondary sex traits, and the things that happen at menopause and andropause. So sex traits are many. It's not just the XY and XX. We have XXYY. We have Leanne has cells that are XY in some of the cells and a single X in other parts of her cells. So we have mosaic genetic traits. Gonads, as I just said, can be ovaries or testes. You can have one of each. And you can have gonads, as Dr. Bauma showed me, that are a blending of testicular and ovarian tissue. Now, hormones don't just come from the gonads, so I've listed them separately. But hormones have to be received. And in androgen insensitivity, what you'll see is that these people have XY chromosomes, typically male. I don't have to explain that in this room. I do it other places. Testes that secrete the typical amount of male hormones. But the cells can't absorb that testosterone, can't use it. So as you heard Megan say in the film, she said, so my body converts male hormones into female hormones, and that's what I react to. It is what happens at puberty when testosterone surges again, but testosterone and estrogen are not that different from each other chemically. You guys, some of you will know that better than me, how to explain that. So it's a conversion so that at puberty, these people with XY chromosomes and testes naturally develop breasts, their skeleton changes, hips widen. They can't menstruate because they don't have a uterus. Some have a vagina, but it's usually very short. It's called a blind vagina because it doesn't go anywhere. Congenital adrenal hyperplasia is kind of the opposite. You have XX chromosomes and ovaries, but you have higher than typical levels of testosterone circulating in the system. This is the most common cause of ambiguous genitalia, CAH, as we call it. And a person's body, their genitals can look anywhere from classically female to classically male in a lot of ranges in between, depending on how high those testosterone levels are. In Anunnaki's case, he was given hormone suppression throughout his growing up life, and it made him very sick, landed him in a wheelchair, and just his life was really, really difficult until he finally, in his late 40s, stopped all of the medications that were suppressing his natural hormone levels, and he became so much healthier out of the wheelchair. Lots of changes there. 5-alpha reductase deficiency syndrome is more rare. In this case, the individual cannot process the stronger form of testosterone early. So when they're born, they have female-looking genitals. But at puberty, that testosterone surges again, and testes descend into the labia, the clitoris enlarges to look more like a phallus. And there are certain cultures where this is more common. The Dominican Republic and Papua New Guinea are two places where this has been very common. Part of the culture, they have language for it. They have rituals for transitioning these individuals from the female roles to the male roles. In the Dominican, it's called Guivadoches, which means eggs at 12. At 12 or around puberty, those testes descend into the labia. Ovotestes I've explained, and many other variations. So the other thing you need to know is that some of these intersex variations impact gender identity, and some really don't. CAH is, people with CAH are often dissatisfied with the sex they're assigned at birth, and many of them identify as non-heterosexual. People with androgen insensitivity, over 90% identify as women. That's their gender identity, and their sexuality, you know, is varied because sexuality is varied. So if you're an intersex person, if you're a non-intersex person, we call that endosex. So your sex is, all your sex traits line up in a typical fashion. But if you're intersex, then one of these or many of these traits is going to vary. But an intersex person can have any gender identity or any sexual orientation. They can identify as transgender, a transgender man, a transgender woman, although that's not the majority. They can identify as gender non-binary or agender or gender fluid. And many of them don't want you to assume that just because their body is a mix of sex characteristics, that their gender is necessarily gender non-binary, because their gender oftentimes is male or is woman or man. And their sexuality, which I don't think we got it up here, can be anywhere along the straight, gay, lesbian, bi, asexual, and all of the other ones that are there. So I wanted to just give you some of this to work with. I've removed some of the pathologizing language that's here. You'll sometimes see androgen insensitivity syndrome because, as I said, many intersex people don't see these as problems to be fixed. And the fixing, as you read in the program, has caused physical, psychological, and spiritual trauma in our attempts to medically perform plastic surgery to make genitals, healthy genitals, appear more typical. So in trying to make healthy genitals appear more typical, you're cutting into very sensitive genital tissue. You're creating scar tissue that doesn't stretch, and you're affecting sensation. So you're causing sexual dysfunction, lifelong pain, and many other problems. Now, intersex people have been used in the culture wars as pawns. So sometimes those in the LGBTQ plus community will say, see, sex is diverse, sex is a spectrum, therefore sexuality, you know, accept us all, without paying attention to the particular concerns of intersex people, primarily the ending of non-consensual, non-medically necessary surgeries and hormonal suppression and treatment to try to make their bodies move away from the natural androgyny that they might be. And some of the, especially in the United States, where I'm more familiar, some of the laws that are against trans people will actually carve out exceptions for intersex children and say, okay, we don't want you to touch trans kids, don't alter their bodies, let them be as God made them. But intersex kids, yeah, go ahead. You can keep cutting their genitals. You can keep messing with their hormones. So there's this big inconsistency about how we care for people. So the folks who are saying, let people live in the body God gave you, are still saying it's okay to alter intersex kids. So there's an inconsistency there. And the other thing that we'll talk about a little later is the question of brain sex. So right now, the difference between a transgender person and an intersex person who transitions from the sex they're assigned at birth to something else is that an intersex person can point to one of these traits identifiable by physicians. And that is the way, that is the dividing line currently for us to understand the difference between intersex people who also identify as trans and transgender people. Now, it's very difficult to get the kind of testing to verify these things. There are many trans folk who would be like, I would love to get all of my, you know, cells tested. I would love to get my hormones tested, but I can't afford it. But there's also this question of brain sex. Now, we know that at scale, we can analyze brain patterns of males and females, and we see differences between them. You can't look at an individual scan and tell whether that person is male or female. It doesn't work like that. There's too much diversity. But we're also doing scans of trans people, and what we find is that the male pattern and the female pattern in brain scans looks like this for trans people. And for trans folk, their brain scan looks closer to the gender identity that they have, not the biological sex with all of these traits. So this is a growing field. It's not currently used to differentiate intersex from trans, but I think the science is certainly pointing in this direction, and I think we'll know more as neuroscience helps us with that. So, how do we think about this as Christians? That's really what I'm here to talk with you about. But I realized that I needed to do a little more science for those of you who don't work in biology. So, this is very important for us to figure out, and thankfully, we find help in none other than the words of Jesus, who in Matthew 19 is answering a question, weighing in on a Jewish first century debate about how can I get rid of my wife? If she burns the toast, can I divorce her? And Jesus says, wait a minute, you've forgotten that God made them male and female and the two shall become one flesh. He's quoting the first chapters of Genesis. And then the disciples are like, well, if it's hard to get divorced, maybe we just shouldn't marry at all. Jesus was saying, no, you're not understanding me. Not everyone can accept this, but those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made so eunuchs by others, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let anyone accept this who has any idea what I'm talking about. I have a 50-page chapter in my book, Sex Difference in Christian Theology, on the history of the interpretation of this passage, okay? It's been translated and interpreted very differently through the ages. The second category of eunuch, castrated men, was very familiar in the ancient world. Boys and men had their testicles crushed or removed. They were mostly enslaved people. Boys kidnapped and castrated and sold into slavery to serve in aristocratic households in the first century where Jesus is talking. They're very expensive slaves, and they were used as exotic sex toys by those who could afford them. People would castrate boys and pimp them out as prostitutes. Sexual slavery was a major problem in the ancient world, and it bothers me that it's not addressed in the New Testament. I have some other writings where I say, well, could this word in this context be addressing sexual slavery? Because it's not there. They were also used as high-ranking slaves in some households because they couldn't impregnate royal women and thus threaten the dynasty. Historian Catherine Ringrose called them perfect servants, and it's very likely that Daniel and his three friends in Persia, there were over 3,000 eunuchs serving the king, and Daniel and the boys were chosen because they were beautiful and wise, and they became advisors. It's very likely that they were castrated eunuchs. The other kind of castrated eunuchs known well in Jesus' time were men who practiced self-castration in worship of the Great Mother, which was a popular ancient religion, the Magna Mater. And if men could castrate themselves in worship of the Great Mother, why wouldn't Christian men think that they could not castrate themselves in honor of the kingdom of heaven? Like, if you're really devoted, are you more devoted than these guys who are worshiping the Great Mother? Now, this may sound crazy to some of us, but in the ancient world where people were often killed for their Christianity and they shed blood for their testimony, it wasn't too radical an idea to castrate oneself for the kingdom of heaven. And many men did this, so much so that at the Council of Nicaea, they actually made a ruling and said, if you've castrated yourselves, you can't be ordained. But if someone castrated you against your will, you can be ordained. And yet some men still were taking Jesus literally beyond the Council of Nicaea. The church eventually tried to convince people, no, these are monks and nuns. These are religious people who renounce marriage and dedicate themselves to God. But it took many centuries for the Roman church to get there. Some Christians believe that they were inaugurating the kingdom of heaven because several verses later in Jesus' speech in Matthew, he talks about at the resurrection where there is neither marriage, marrying or being given in marriage, but being like the angels. And angels were pictured in ancient iconography as beardless men, which is exactly how eunuchs presented in the world. So when you see ancient pictures of eunuchs and ancient pictures of angels, they look very much the same. Some believe they were rejecting the patriarchal power and privilege of the day. Angels also were mediators between God and humanity, between the aristocrats and everybody else, and between men and women. And in the Byzantine Christian Empire, it became very common, well, not very common, but some in the mid to late Byzantine Empire, parents would even castrate their own boy in order to give him the opportunity to serve as a eunuch, either of the emperor and the empress or in the church. So there was an understanding of that in the Eastern Church. In the Roman Church, they castrated boys to sing in the choir, because women must be silent in churches. But if you want a really robust choir, you want all the voices. And this went on for centuries. The last castrati singer to sing in the Sistine Chapel was in the 20th century, Alessandro Morisci. He was called the last angel of Rome. And you can actually listen to a recording of his voice from 1902 on YouTube. He died in 1922, 101 years ago. I find this very important to this current conversation, because very strong statements have come out of the Vatican about not altering sex traits. And yet for 19 centuries, Rome was doing exactly that for their choirs. But back to our text, I digress. In all of these discussions about whose bodies were altered, it's important that we go back to our text and realize there's another kind of eunuch that Jesus mentioned, those who've been eunuchs from birth. Now, we know that being circumcised was a really important thing in Judaism. Therefore, one needs to know whom to circumcise and who should not be circumcised. And so when there was a question with a child, rabbis would be called in to make a determination. And over time, they developed extra sex categories so that they could talk about the religious obligations of this child or that child as they grew. The Saris Chama, this is Hebrew and it stands for eunuch of the sun. Saris is the word for eunuch. Chama is the word for sun. From the moment the sun shone upon the child, they knew this one was different. Ilonit. So the Saris Chama are on the masculine side of center. The Ilonit are on the feminine side of center. And Draganas is, they're right in the middle. We can't make a determination one way or another. And Tumtum, the sex is unclear, but we'll probably figure out it out in time. And Saris Adam, I include that. So a eunuch made by a human. These were the castrated men. So they added these categories so that they could speak about everyone in their community and think about what religious obligations these folks were required. Now, Jesus uses the first term and the last term in Matthew 19:12. We find evidence of this language in hundreds of occurrences in Mishnah and Talmud. These were not uncommon. There's a rabbi in our documentary who explains a lot of this. Andragonos was also a term that was used in Christian literature, and no less than Augustine. Now, I never saw this in my seminary required reading, but it's there. As for androgynes, also called hermaphrodites, they're certainly very rare, but it's difficult to find periods when there are no examples of human beings possessing the characteristics of both sexes in such a way that it is a matter of doubt how they should be classified. However, the prevalent usage calls them masculine, assigning them to the better sex. Augustine, you can like love him and hate him in the same passage. He tells us that intersex folks were known in the ancient world. He also shows the hierarchy of being. In the ancient world, human perfection was masculine perfection. Eunuchs and effeminate men were under that. Androgynous and hermaphrodites were kind of in the middle. And then you had the feminine people at the bottom. Roman laws covering what was required. They're basically, eunuchs had a third legal status in the ancient world. They couldn't testify in court or leave a last will and testament. And if you look at the root word of that, you may understand why. Have you ever read the passages in the Old Testament where someone places a hand under their thigh in order to make a vow? They put their hand on their genitals and made a promise. So eunuchs and women did not have the physical anatomy to be able to make a last will and testament or to testify in court. You know, the ancient world was very different than ours. Despite the fact that the rabbis eventually added extra categories and made special provisions for naturally born eunuchs, it wasn't easy to be a eunuch in the ancient world, especially in Israel, where castrated eunuchs were not even allowed to go to worship. In Deuteronomy, castrated eunuchs are not allowed to worship in the assembly. Now, the crazy thing is Jesus knows about this law in Deuteronomy. Why on earth would he tell his disciples to consider making themselves like a eunuch, like those who aren't permitted to worship? What on earth was he talking about? Eunuchs were the epitome of outsiders. But what I love about Jesus is he kind of had a thing for outsiders. He got in trouble for hanging out with outsiders. And Jesus knew that this Deuteronomy passage was not the only passage in the Hebrew Bible that addressed eunuchs. He knew about this very important passage in Isaiah, which talks about eunuchs. Eunuchs who are like, come on, God, we love you, we want to worship you, why are we cut out from worship because of our bodies in Deuteronomy? So they complain, and the Lord cares about their complaints and speaks to them through the prophet Isaiah, saying, don't let the foreigner join to the Lord, say, the Lord will surely separate me from his people. Do not let the eunuch say, I'm just a dry tree. For thus says the Lord, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose the things that please me and hold fast to my covenant, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. Even God or Isaiah can work a pun into their blessing. You'll get it in a minute. And to the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord, to minister him to him, to love the Lord, be his servants, keep his Sabbath, don't profane it, hold to the covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all people. All throughout the Old Testament, we hear instructions given to Israel to keep themselves separate from foreigners. Actually, the passage in Deuteronomy that excludes castrated eunuchs excludes foreigners and the children of foreigners from being able to worship down to, you know, so many generations. And so many scholars believe that the exclusion of eunuchs in Deuteronomy 22 has to do with this practice as part of cults and other religions outside of Israel, like the Magna Mater, where men would castrate themselves in worship of their deity. Now, that was the rule earlier in Deuteronomy. But by the time we get to Isaiah, God seems to be doing something new. Not only in including eunuchs, but now including Gentiles who are also forbidden to worship in the assembly, according to Deuteronomy. The very people God had said not to mix with are now being given blessings. So looking back at this first part of the passage, we see that God is promising a special blessing on eunuchs. He doesn't bless them by fixing them. He doesn't bless them by returning them to some perfect manhood so they can propagate their name as good Jewish boys did by having sons who begat sons who begat sons. God promises them an everlasting name. And while this promise is given in the book of Isaiah, it took a while for God's people to get with the program. Certainly Matthew 19 was reminding his disciples of what God had said in the prophet Isaiah. Jesus quotes a lot from Isaiah in the book of Matthew. And he says that eunuchs can be exemplary disciples. But it was the early church needed an angelic visitor, like the Son of God wasn't good enough, to finally get the point across. And this we find in the book of Acts, where an angel says to Philip, go down to the road. This is a very familiar passage. Here is an Ethiopian eunuch. So he's an official in the court of Candace. He fits that ancient description of eunuchs who were slaves in aristocratic households and trusted to guard haram, to take care of finances, to do lots of things. And he had traveled all the way from Ethiopia to Jerusalem to worship. And he's returning home in his chariot. And he happens to be reading the prophet Isaiah. How about that? And Philip asks him, do you understand what you're reading? He says, no. He invites him into the chariot. And Philip, from this passage, starts to tell him about the good news of Jesus. And then the eunuch asks, what is to prevent me from being baptized? Now, until I studied eunuchs in the ancient world, this question didn't jump out at me. But after learning that eunuchs were not allowed to worship with Israel, after realizing that he would travel all these miles from Ethiopia to Jerusalem, he couldn't enter the court of men. He couldn't enter the court of women. He could only enter the court of Gentiles. So he's a third-class citizen when he goes to worship Yahweh in Jerusalem. And so he's wondering, what is my status going to be if I follow this Rabbi Jesus? Am I still going to be a third-class citizen in my religious community? The frustrating thing is that we don't get to read what Philip said to him. Sometimes I wonder if he said what Paul says in Galatians, that through baptism we are clothed with Christ. There's no longer Jew or Gentile, Jew or Ethiopian. There's no longer slave or free. There's no longer male and female, for you are all one in Christ and heirs according to that promise. I don't know what Philip said, but someone said the chariot should stop. And they both got down, and Philip baptized him and then was whisked away by the Spirit. Now you might be thinking, okay, Megan, that's all well and good, but we know that God created Adam and Eve, male and female, in Genesis. So how do we reconcile what Jesus says in eunuchs, says in Matthew, with what Isaiah says, and with the book of Acts? I'm very glad that you asked. Now, I am sure that as science professors at Christian universities, you spend a lot of time helping students understand that the opening chapters of Genesis are not a science textbook, that it's a theological text written in Hebrew poetic style, communicating truths about God and humankind. And it has certain themes. And we see one important theme is this theme of separation, separating light from dark, separating the waters below from the waters above. We heard during our devotions, thank you so much, that they had a different cosmology in the ancient world. The waters were below and the waters were above. And so God is separating those waters from the other. And then we even see that the animals are separated into different categories. Fish of the sea, birds of the air, and living things that move on the earth. Now, this is the time for you to talk back to me. Can you think of animals that do not fit these creation categories?
Bats.
Frogs.
Whales.
Flying squirrels. Flying squirrels. I haven't heard that one.
Platypuses.
Platypuses.
Penguins.
Ostriches. There are many animals that don't fit into these categories. Have you ever heard a sermon on Genesis 1 that says bats are a sign of the fall? That whales are a sign of the fall because they do not fit the creation categories that we find in Genesis 1. These are animals that blend these categories together. So why do Christians automatically assume that people whose bodies fall between male and female are signs of the fall and not what God wanted, simply because they're not listed in verse 27? Genesis 1 lists night and day, but omits dawn and dusk, which are the times we take out our phones to take pictures of the glory of God being seen in the sky. They list land and sea, but no shore, no marshes, no estuaries where salt water and fresh water mix. And estuaries have an important place in Earth's ecosystems. I don't think we would call them a result of the fall. I think we would call them God's good creation. So if we can call estuaries good, can we call male and female and all the gradations in between good and beautiful and as God intended? Now, theologians are a lot like scientists. We look at as much evidence as we can find and we work to make sense of it. We establish hypotheses and theories to make sense of the data. Now, the question before us is, how do we honor the opening chapters of Genesis, the creation of Adam and Eve, male and female, and reconcile this with the data in Isaiah, Matthew, and the book of Acts? Now, here are a few hypothetical theological lenses that I've come up with that I believe help us to honor all of these passages in Scripture. What if, instead of interpreting Adam and Eve as the pattern after which all people are made, we interpret them as the parents? What if we, instead of interpreting them as God's best or the only kinds of humans who are good, we see them as the beginning of the story? What if, instead of seeing them as the exclusive model, we understand them as the statistical majority? Understanding Genesis as the beginning of the story helps us to honor all of the Bible, interpreting each segment in context. Now, the story begins in Genesis with this theme of separation, a theme that runs through other earlier parts of Israel's story, making distinction between clean animals and unclean animals. Unclean animals bring abomination on the one who eats them. And they have to make these separations so that they can remember that God has separated them from the nations. God delivered them from Egypt. God made them their own, his own. We find light and darkness, these separations in Genesis. We find instructions in Leviticus about not mixing creation categories. And many of the animals that are forbidden are those that mix creation categories. Shellfish, you know, they're in the sea, but they do not have fins and scales. Bees, things that swarm, are in the sky, but they're not birds. A lot of these are the animals that Israel is forbidden to eat. And in Deuteronomy, we hear, don't mix seeds of the different kinds in your garden. Don't mix two kinds of fabrics at the loom. Don't mix up men and women's clothing. Don't let eunuchs worship with Israel. Don't let Gentiles worship with Israel. This theme of separation is big. And holy, the word for holy in Hebrew, means separate. Israel was separated from the tribes of the earth, and they were given rituals to help them remember their story so that in the garden, they would remember that they're separated. At the loom, they would remember that they're separated. At the table, they would be reminded that they are to be separate. But then God does something new in this passage that we talked about. And then God does something really new by becoming incarnate. And Jesus says new things to us. And he says, he who has ears, let them hear. And then we see the church doing new things. We have Philip's baptism. We have Peter commanded to eat the foods that make one an abomination. And we have Peter commanded to stop separating from Gentiles. And we have Galatians 3, which we also read. Adam and Eve are the beginning of a grand story that over time folds in other kinds of people. The Christian story is not a circle. It's not creation, fall, and return to the garden. The Christian story is a story that has a beginning, it has a middle, and it has an end. And as we look at that end in Revelation, we see a great multitude gathered before the Lamb worshiping from every nation, tribe, people, and language. Now talk to me. In the garden, do we have different kind of people groups? Do we have different kind of languages? Do we have different kinds of tribes? The end of the story is not like the beginning. The end has so much more diversity than what we find at the beginning. We are not called to return to Eden. Even though I named my second child Eden, because Eden is really important, we're not called to get back to Eden, but we're called to live into the already but not yet, seeing the kingdom that God has promised us. But the truth is, we are not yet a house of prayer for all people. Our churches are not places where everyone is welcome. I've talked to so many intersex people who are not welcome in churches. Some Christians say they'll make a distinction. They'll make an exception for intersex people, but not trans people who can't prove that they have all of these sex traits. But no one should be asked by their pastor to submit medical records in order to be able to worship at church. Right? I hope you can agree with me on that. This is what I hear from intersex people. This is a friend of mine, a Christian, who talks about when people go through cancer or their kids go through cancer, people are supportive. But with an intersex kid, there's no support from the church. The kids are shamed. Families are asked to leave churches. Christians treat us like lepers. The intersex community needs fellowship. It is the church's responsibility to care for us. I'm still a born-again believer, but I struggle. I know God loves me, but it's the church. In other words, we still have a lot of work to do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Megan. We have a few minutes for questions. I just want to remind us that we always work in a spirit of respect respectful dialogue. This is so enlightening what you've shared with us. Thank you so much. And I just want to add one comment, and that is it may be tempting to tell things because we each have a different perspective. Let's focus this morning on asking Megan specifically about what she's shared with us so that we can keep our questions relatively short and get through quite a few.
You're arguing that these intersex traits should not be surgically modified at birth. There are other minority traits like cleft palate, affects about 1 in 1,000, that I think we would all agree should be modified at birth. So can you give a sort of a framework for how to decide what should and should not be modified?
Yeah, that's a great question, really legitimate. I think what it is that when those kids who have cleft palate grow up, They're not complaining or advocating against those surgeries. What we hear from the intersex community after 30, 40, 50 years of early surgeries is that trauma, physical problems are created by these surgeries. In our trailer for the movie, you heard Tiger DeVore say that if I'd never had that first surgery, I would never have had a surgery in my life. He's had 26 surgeries in the course of his life to correct the rerouting of his urethra through his penis. He has to catheterize himself all the time. He's had so much trauma from that particular surgery. So it's listening to the community. So if people who had cleft palate were like, why did you do this to me as a child? I want to make this choice myself. We would hopefully listen. That is what the intersex community is saying, is I want the choice. I want to be old enough to make a choice about my body. If you take intersex genitals and you choose through doctors' guesses, probability of whether they will identify as boy or a girl, you remove tissue that can't be put back. And so if you say, okay, there's an 80% chance with this particular kind of intersex trait that they're going to identify as a girl, and then they identify as a boy, you've removed the very tissue that is their body. When they're old enough, they might want those genitals to be reconstructed to look more typical. They might not. They might say the risks are too big and I want to be healthy and I want to have all of the sensation in my genitals that everybody else gets. Great question.
Thank you for drawing our attention to the injustices that have been done. A couple of things. First of all, I'm wondering if the male and female in Genesis could be interpreted as social categories as opposed to biological categories. And secondly, I wonder if you've engaged with the disability literature at all. There's a lot of arguments that conditions such as Down syndrome be considered as creational diversity as opposed to disability. Mm-hmm. I guess one of the big differences, and I would also question, you know, how much we look at conditions, I'm not even sure what term to use anymore,
right,
that are variations like 1% of the population to define sort of what's normal. And of course, we only have access to it. World tainted by sin. But I guess a big difference is we don't have a whole sub-community advocating for a surgery to make somebody appear and act like someone with Down syndrome, which is what is happening with that transgender issues.
Can you repeat that last question again?
So one of the differences with intersex is, like you said, people are using it to normalize or justify transgender surgeries, hormone therapies. Mm-hmm. But we don't have people who are advocating or wanting surgery and other medical treatments to make them like someone with Down syndrome. And I mean, that might be a bit of an extreme comparison, but yeah, just the principle.
Yeah. So I'll address that, because what we do hear from the trans community is a similar message to what we hear from intersex folks, is that I want the choice. I want the ability to make choices about my body that make sense for me. Intersex folks sometimes will choose to say, the sex you assigned me at birth doesn't fit my gender identity. Anunnaki in the film says that. And so he transitions later in life, and now he's an outcast like all the trans folk. There are many, as I said, we have more sex traits that we don't know as much about, but we do have some of these that are pointing toward trans folk having sex brains that are sexed differently than an endosex male or an endosex female. And so recognizing that this bodily diversity is connected to choice and connected to one's understanding of oneself is part of what we're dealing with. Disability literature has been very helpful for helping us communicate about this. As I said, some intersex people do like the DSD language. and they do see their intersex variations as a medical problem. Others say, fix my medical problem. If you have CAH, there's a salt imbalance, and you have to take cortisol. You have to manage that. And so my friends with CAH are like, yeah, help me manage my salt imbalance and my cortisol, but you don't need to alter my genitals. Like, address a medical problem with medical situation, address a social challenge with social solutions. So trying to differentiate those. Does that answer your question?
Thank you so much. Really appreciate what you've shared with us today. And just two quickly things. Where can we get the references for your scientific stuff? Because I really am interested in looking at that more. I see the you and fact sheet, but I don't see some of your other references that I would just like to
read. Well, I have tons of footnotes in Sex Difference in Christian Theology. And the first chapter in that is all about.
Okay.
It's a little dated because I started it in 2007 when I was writing my dissertation. It finally came out in 2015, and there's a lot more that's been done, but it will give you, you know, quite a bit. And there's a lot out there.
Excellent. No, I know there's a lot. That's why I was interesting to get that from. Also, you're saying they should decide. And we know that the brain development sometimes goes to like 25 years. So just your opinion, when do you think somebody's capable?
Well, it's the prefrontal cortex that's not developed until 28. But there are other parts of our brain that are quite developed. And this is where talking to people, there are children who know around age 3, kids start to get a sense that they're a boy or a girl. And there are a minority of children who say, wait a minute, I don't feel like a girl. I don't feel like a boy. I am really uncomfortable with this stuff. It can happen that young, 3, 4, 5. And we know from research and studying folks that many of them, that persists into puberty and beyond, whether or not they have had medical interventions, hormone interventions. So this is where the listening to the community is really important. And I know we don't have these long-term studies yet. As Donna Strickland said, look, we're in the middle of doing this science. So we're trying to figure it out. But having looked at the literature, there is so much evidence on the side of biological influence on gender identity and gendered behavior. And again, I reference CAH. Why is it? So 48% of the intersex community is not interested in affiliation with the LGBTQ community. 52% are. That is significantly higher than 7% of the endosex community. Which to me says there's something going on here biologically. And some intersex traits have, like I said, a lot of dissatisfaction with sex assignment or a straight sexuality, and others don't. Why is that? Well, it's because their sex traits are different. Intersex people are the only ethical way that we can test some of our theories. Like, we can castrate rats in the lab and change their sexual behavior, change their gendered behavior, change their parenting behavior. It's unethical to do that to humans. So I hope we all agree on that. Can I get an amen? So intersex traits are our best way. Unfortunately, it means that they're highly studied, which is not comfortable, like, as a person. But this is where we can learn about a lot of this stuff.
Megan, thank you so much for your talk, but in particular, mentioning Bud Bauma. And for those in the audience who don't know, Hessler Bud was the head of our bioethics commission for a number of years here in the ASA. So this is not a fresh, brand new conversation for us in this community, and his memory is rich and his contributions. So thank you. I want to ask you, in that light, if you see any connections between this conversation and what's happening, and things I know Bud worked on, and that's the beginning of life, the whole right to life movement, the abortion and euthanasia conversations going on. It seems to me that there's there are questions there about making decisions for
people.
Yes,
there are.
And if losing your gonads, losing your sex tissues is one thing, losing your life is something else. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you see things here that might relate to that.
What I see is a lot of hypocrisy among Christians who are aborting children who are identified in utero as intersex, particularly with CAH. My work with the intersex community, I was like, you have got to learn to talk to Christians, because if everybody else is aborting these babies, the only intersex kids we're going to have in the world are going to be raised in pro-life households. So we better like educate the community on biological sex diversity. So there's a lot there, the in utero testing, genetic testing. We can decide not to implant embryos which have these genetic traits. So it's very much connected to that conversation.
Hi, Megan. Thank you for your talk. You refer to Matthew 19, where Jesus mentioned eunuchs, and you suggest that there might be the intersex community. So I'm wondering, because the context was talking about like who are better to not married. Mm-hmm. And so do you suggest that like Jesus here is saying like eunuch people, they are like they're better to not get married to avoid their like fleshy thoughts or like, you know, the flesh. Is it what the current intersex community believe?
Thank you for saying that. There are some intersex folks who say, hey, I'm asexual. Sally Gross was actually ordained as a Dominican priest and says, I'm a natural celibate, actually converted from Judaism to Christianity because there was a place for celibacy. But there are many intersex folks for whom that doesn't feel like a gift. And what we hear when the Apostle Paul is saying that I can't impose this on you. I recommend that all of you would renounce marriage so that you can devote yourselves entirely to the Lord. And in my own mind, if endosex males and females can choose to become like the eunuch, can the eunuch choose to become like a male and female and enter into marriage? Just a question that.
Hey, thank you so much for that talk. I'm not a theologian at all, and so I don't know what our...
Every Christian is a capital T theologian.
When you were talking about Genesis 1 and separation of light and dark, water and water, I immediately assumed you were heading to Genesis 2 and the separation of Eve from Adam. Mm-hmm. And then you were going to say something about, hey, Adam, prior to that separation, has these intersex readings. Are there intersex interpretations of Adam?
Oh yeah,
prior
in Judaism
separation?
And in Christianity,
yeah,
they will say that the human, which is made from the dust. I like to call it the earthling, because they're made from the earth. So the earthling, some will say, was originally a hermaphrodite, and then there was the separation. And again, is this a literal text? Is this a theological text that might be using metaphors? We're not going to debate that today.
Okay, we have one more question and then we're going to end this morning.
Yeah. Thank you for your talks, very enlightening, and this all makes a lot of sense. The thing that I wish you would explain a little bit more clearly, because I'm confused, is where is the moral boundary between immoral and moral sex practices? We have Moses' law in Leviticus, a man should not lay with his women, but a man should not lay with a man as with a woman, but expand this a little bit more. Like, you shouldn't lay with, it includes adultery. You shouldn't lay with your father's wife because it would dishonor him. You shouldn't, it's all these things. So it's a lot of, it's not just homosexuality there. It's adultery. There's a whole gamut of being unfaithful to your wife. But it's in that category, and it's a whole bunch of things we should not engage with. And in the book of Acts, when they try to figure out what laws the Gentiles were supposed to keep, they were supposed to abstain from sexual impurity.
Yes,
and porneia. Places in the New Testament where, now in Greco-Roman Empire, homosexuality was very rampant, but so was adultery, all
the
kinds
of... The short answer to your question is read this book, and you'll get my answer, because there's no way I can answer that here. There are too many texts. Those are important texts, and we need to look at them. It's not a slam dunk from sexual diversity or biological sex diversity to then... sexual anything goes. That's our responsibility as Christians to ask those ethical questions.
Yeah, so I will read that book because I'm a little bit confused, but I want to make clear that this is not really only a problem with homosexuals. It's also heterosexuals.
It's for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Christian tradition, you know, helps us think about what should sexual ethics be today for all of us.
Well,
thank you for asking that.
Thank you, everyone, for your questions. So please join me in thanking sincerely again Megan DeFranza for her words today.